It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, folks. Before we get into this week's episode, I just want to make a short announcement. This June, I'll be heading over to London to take part in CrimeCon UK, partnered by CBS Reality, expert-led true crime TV channel. CrimeCon is a convention for lovers of all things true crime related, taking place on Saturday the 11th and Sunday the 12th of June 2022. It's perfect for true crime lovers and there'll be a lot to see over the 2 days. I'll be on Podcast Row with 30 other true crime podcasters. As well as that, there will be live recordings with studio audiences and also different talks with criminologists, police and victims of crimes as well. Limited early bird tickets are on sale now and listeners of the Troubles podcast can get a 10% discount if they enter the code TROUBLES when purchasing their tickets. So please do come along and say hi. It'd be great to finally meet fans of the podcast. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. Now back to the podcast. This week's episode of the podcast features my interview with Colin Ferguson, who is a Scottish soldier who was stationed in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. In the interview, we talk about how he ended up there and what it was like. We also discussed some recent issues, such as his opinion on whether soldiers should be held accountable for deaths that they caused during the Troubles. Having people on from all sides of the conflict is very important to me with this podcast, and absolutely essential when it comes to telling the history of a conflict. And I hope you find this interview as informative as I did. Now let's get into it.
So Colin, you're from Scotland, and do you want to tell me a little bit about yourself then, before we get into this chat? So where were you born?
I was born in the west coast of Scotland, back in the mid-60s. We emigrated to Australia as a kid. We spent 6 or 7 years in Australia before coming back to Scotland. And then I left school at 16. I worked down in London for a bit. And this was the early 80s, really high unemployment, 16% in Scotland. So I decided I needed some direction in life. And after working a few years in London, I joined the army just a week before my 20th birthday.
And was it just the army was a good idea for a career or kind of get you into line? Or what was kind of your feelings or going into it?
I'd always wanted to join. But I sort of put it off for a bit till I got some life experience, if you like. But to be perfectly frank, Oisin, there was no real opportunities back in the west coast of Scotland back then. As I said, there was 16% unemployment. So in a lot of respects, it was a way out. And the army always has been that way for people, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, isn't there a lot of education programs and things like you can use it to better yourself up and then you can get out in a better position? You can get like a university degree or that sort of stuff.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and when you joined the army, you'd absolutely no idea where you'd be sent or what sort of what you'd be doing.
You had a rough idea from the recruiting brochures, which always show you the sunny islands with people windsurfing. But the reality was, I ended up in Germany during the Cold War in a place called Dortmund, and Germany back then was a great posting for people in the army.
Okay, because there was relatively low conflict or low risk of an actual breakout of violence.
The standard of living was much higher than the UK, and you got additional money for being out there. I mean, when you came back off leave, Britain seemed a real dump compared to Germany. A lot of it was shiny, new, well, and well looked after.
So you're in Germany during the Cold War. So what were you doing over there?
I volunteered to do a service with a unit that was involved in what's called stay behind observation posts. So basically, you would dig in on the inner-German border. You'd let the lead elements of the Soviet Union forces roll over you, and then you you would come out and deploy into observation posts and engage the main bodies of the Soviet army with artillery and rockets of the British army.
Okay, so you'd be surrounded on all fronts, basically? They'd be behind you in front of you? Or
yes, absolutely. You'd be like 20, well, from 0 to 20 kilometres ahead of your own forces.
Wow, okay. And so not necessarily undercover, but you would basically hide and then let them pass over you and then you'd pop up.
Yeah, we'd just be situated, dug in holes in the ground. It wasn't undercover, it was your uniform all the time. And yeah, you'd engage them from these holes in the ground, hiding.
And was there a lot of activity at the time, or was it more just to kind of be there and have a presence?
It was be there and just wait for that the big day when the Cold War went hot, essentially.
So luckily that never happened.
Yeah, thankfully.
So you were out there for a few years then, was it?
Yeah, I spent 7 years there, and then when the wall came down, they started relocating quite a few army units back to the UK. So we returned to the UK at that point.
And then do you choose, when you're in the army like this, do you choose what you want to get into? Do you want to be like, say, intelligence or, I don't know, driving? I know nothing about the army, so excuse me for some of these questions. But do you choose your kind of area?
You do have a choice. When you join up, you set a number of tests that discuss your aptitude and find out how intelligent you are. And then from that, they can say, right, we can offer you this, this and this. But when you go in, yeah, you can say, this is what I want to join. And if you pass all the tests to get into that area, then you can go there.
Okay. So, yeah, I covered a little bit of that in, I think it was the Captain Nairac episode. So kind of I did an episode on kind of joining the FRU, the Force Research Unit. Yeah. So it's kind of the ultra high British Army intelligence in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you had to be a trained soldier already to volunteer for that. Specialist unit. So you had to get in the army first, get some service under your belt, and then go for the selection courses for these specialist units.
Then was there a gap between Germany and then you getting stationed in Northern Ireland, or was it from one straight to the other?
No, what happened was they had a system called Roulement Tours, and basically every 2 or 3 years your regiment or battalion would go away and do a tour in Northern Ireland. But for some battalions, you'd then do what was called a 2-year residency tour. So you'd be posted over to Northern Ireland for 2 years. And these battalions would offer sort of the continuity for the to support the battalions that have been sort of transitioned in and out. Because if you went for a Roulement tour, back in the sort of up to the mid-80s, you did 4.5 months. And then in the mid-80s onwards, it became a 6-month tour.
Okay, so most units that we station in Northern Ireland would be 4 to 6 months, and then they'd be back again.
Yes, apart from the Roulement battalions. Now, bear in mind, at the height of the Troubles, there was 20,000 soldiers in Northern Ireland. You think that the British Army is only 80,000 strong, and it was 150,000 strong back then.
Well, wasn't it the largest since the Falklands or something? It was the largest deployment of British soldiers, the Troubles?
Yeah. Oh, I think actually there's probably more soldiers deployed in the Falklands than there was, sorry, in Northern Ireland than there was in the Falklands.
I didn't know that. But you do have a good podcast episode about, and we'll talk about your podcast later, about Operation Banner. And so just first off, you were deployed into Northern Ireland then, was this around 1985 or a little bit later?
I did two tours. I did one in 1988 to Derry, Londonderry. And then did another one in 1994, just as the peace process started, to Keady.
To where, say? Oh, Keady. So, well, no, but what I listened to in the podcast said that before, even if you're coming out to Northern Ireland for 4.5 months, you had to do that alone in training, about 4.5 months of training just before you got out here.
That's correct, yeah.
So would that training be very different? I guess because we're coming into the context where we talk about theatres of war, which is like the streets of Northern Ireland are very different to a lot of the other places that you would have been stationed in. So I'd imagine the training was very, very unique, I guess, was it?
Yes, it was. It was very intense. You started off doing an in-barracks package, which lasted about 4 months or so. 4 weeks or so. And then you transitioned to... There was places like in Germany and the UK, down in Lydenhyde in the UK, they had a place called Tin City, which was a mocked-up urban village. And you had a security force base in there. Other army units played the civilian population. So you go out, go on a patrol and carry out all the training that you've done. And you've lived in there for the final exercise. I think you lived in there for something like 7 days, just pretending you're on exercise in Northern, sorry, you're on operations in Northern Ireland. And during that time in Tin City, you'd be subjected to everything that you could be subjected over there. Crowd disturbances, including the use of petrol bombs. They never used to throw bricks at you. They would throw lumps of coal or potatoes. Potatoes were a favourite. Still hurt you when they hit you. How to put in cordons if they found an improvised explosive device, bombs going off. You know, people getting shot in your patrol, people getting blown up. They take out commanders, so the person in the patrol would have to step up, take command of the patrol. So basically, any situation you could possibly find yourself in Northern Ireland, you'd rehearse in Tin City. And obviously, you did a lot of range work. There were strict rules of engagement under the, what was called the yellow card. And this outlined when you could and could not open fire. So you'd often be on the ranges under yellow card conditions. And again, these ranges would be simulating areas that you'd be working in.
So would a yellow card conditions be, would that be the equivalent of saying, say there's a lot of civilians around? I understand, and we probably will get to that later. But like, so would this be your, you have to be a force, but you can't use lethal force, I guess? Or what does yellow card condition mean?
You could only use lethal force as an absolute last resort.
Say, so you got deployed into Northern Ireland then in 1988. Was that like early in the year or later on in the year?
Just at the very end of 1988, yeah. So mid-December 1988.
And before you arrived into Northern Ireland, would you do much of, say, like a knowledge of historical context? Or is that kind of irrelevant for, I guess, as a soldier?
No, you need to know. We were given instruction on that, and most of us took a personal interest. I was quite unique in that I came from the west coast of Scotland, so I wasn't a stranger to sectarianism. Okay. You know, over in the west coast of Scotland, they have orange marching season. You have the rivalry between Celtic and Rangers, and there was a real hatred. You know, Catholic schools and Protestant schools were separate. But in Scotland, it stopped at fighting on the terraces. It never made it any higher to bombings or shootings.
Yeah, whereas a bit of a different case over in Northern Ireland in 1989.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess the question is, what did you think you were going into Northern Ireland to do?
I thought we were going in there to keep the peace between two warring communities, essentially. And essentially that went into, you know, the official mission was to support the RUC and obviously keep the peace between two communities who at that time been more or less, I know it sounds a terrible phrase, at war, but you know, it's called the Troubles, but that's a euphemism.
Yeah.
You know, so we were there to try and keep the peace between two warring communities and do the best we could in some very dire circumstances.
And funnily enough, I guess, but the British government refused to call it a war. You know, on paper, is when you look at how it went down, it was.
Well, I think a war is normally state-on-state declared violence, isn't it? It's like the Falklands wasn't officially a war. That's why it's called the conflict. That's because the British government never declared war on the Argentinian government. But to your point, for the soldier on the ground, for the civilian population on the ground, and for the terrorist group members, it was a war.
Okay, and so you were deployed into Derry.
Yep.
Like I said, I'm from the Republic of Ireland, so I call it Derry. You're from Scotland, and so naturally you call it Londonderry. We're crossing all of our teams.
I think this sums up the situation you're in my original statement. I called it Londonderry, because I'm very aware of what both communities think of that, and that's why I used that phrase.
And it's funny how, you know, relevant it is today. It's still something that is quite, you drive across the border and like it's the London is scratched out of all the signs. So what was your initial operation in Derry? It was just keep the peace and support the RUC.
So we were stationed at a little security base called Fort George on the banks of the River Foyle. And you went in there, you took over from the unit that were in there already. And basically we operated a cycle of 10 days city patrols. And 10 days rural patrols, then 10 days on permanent vehicle checkpoints, PVCPs, and there was three of them on the main transport routes into Derry. And during your 10 days on city patrols, you do 8 hours patrolling in the city, 8 hours security of the base, then 8 hours off.
And how was it patrol? All three of those are very interesting to me. So, like, how was it patrolling the city, you know, with regard to the civilian population?
Nothing prepares you for it. When you go across there, it is surreal because you're essentially, it's like walking down your own high street with a high-powered weapon in your hands. People either ignored you or you could palpably feel the hatred. So for a young guy, it's quite a disconcerting experience when you initially deploy out in the streets for your first few patrols.
And were you ever able to build any sort of rapport or connection with people, or was it people of the Catholic population just wouldn't talk to you?
Yeah, I mean, you'd had your Catholic areas, the Cregan, Bogside, places like that. And yeah, no engagement at all. And you can understand that when you look at the history of what's happened. You know, if you went to some of the Protestant housing estates, you could get a cup of tea and a chat. But you know, you would try and engage both sides politely. But a lot of the time, yeah, you're either told, ignored, met with obscenities, or you know, that was about the engagement you got.
Where did you get things thrown at you? Like, I've kind of
you get everything from dog waste, dog crap, to bricks thrown at you. Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, at this time, were you, because just funny, the previous interview I've done on this podcast was with Richard Moore, who was blinded from a young age from a rubber bullet, or was it a batting round? I'm pretty sure it's a rubber bullet, sorry. But so were you using kind of a combination of the two? Were you fully armed, but also with what they called non-lethal rounds, which ended up being quite lethal in the end? But were you used both at the same time, was it?
Well, you had... We operated in what was called a multiple of 12 soldiers, and there was 3 four-man patrols in this multiple. The multiple itself was led by a sergeant or a young officer, and each of the what was called bricks, the four-man teams, were led by a corporal or a lance corporal. But you all had what the standard British Army rifle, the SLR. I think you carried, about 80 rounds, and one of the people in that patrol was designated the baton gunner, and he carried the baton gun. And that was there in case you got into a sort of a riot situation. And that was generally when baton rounds were fired.
Yeah, for crowd dispersal, I guess that's what it's called.
Yeah, crowd dispersal, crowd control.
And do you think, because they basically, historically, they've gone down pretty horrifically, baton rounds. But do you think that, you know, the likes of yourselves would have known how lethal they ended up being, or were they... Look, anything is better than a real bullet. Was that kind of the logic?
I think just to put it into perspective, we deployed out there for 6 months. We had multiple contacts with IEDs, etc. We had two of our unit killed and half a dozen so badly wounded. I mean, three or four of them were so badly wounded they were invalided out of the army. But nobody in our unit fired any live rounds or baton rounds during that 6 months. As for training on the baton round itself, yeah, you see comprehensive training on them. They were supposed to be fired at people who are sort of the waist down on the legs.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, what they were there for in the riot situation was you were identified. They were used for crowd dispersal just to give you a breathing space to get away if you could. Or yeah. If it's a riot control situation, what you would do is you would identify a ringleader, and a baton round was used to take him down, and then a snatch squad of two or three would go out and grab him and bring him back into the cordon and arrest him. So that okay. was sort of the intentions behind them.
Yeah, and they were meant to bounce off the ground first, wasn't it? They weren't meant to be...
There was two versions. If I remember the original one that came out... I think, again, as I'm scanning my memory back in time here, but I think you meant to bounce them off the ground. The later ones, which were called FRGs, made by Heckler & Koch, they were designed to be fired. They were a lot more accurate and designed to be fired at people directly.
Yeah.
And there was minimum engaging distances as well. You know, you had to be a minimum of, I can't remember, say, for example, 25 metres away. You weren't meant to fire any closer than that, because that's when they became really dangerous.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So I'm kind of just going to move on a little bit because listening to your episode about Operation Banner, I found the concept of like asymmetric warfare quite interesting. So I understand asymmetric warfare is when two forces are engaged in warfare with each other, but they're drastically different sizes. Would that be correct in saying it? Or is it different?
It's slightly different. I would say that does come into it, but asymmetric warfare means there's no distinct front line. So, you know, you look at World War II, there was always a distinct front line between where British troops were and German troops were. In asymmetric warfare, there is no front line. And also, your enemy, in a sort of counter-terrorism strategy, your enemy is amongst the people. So
flashbacks of like the likes of Vietnam, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, it's again, yeah. So there was two sides to Vietnam, and you had the NVA, which were in uniform, and then you had the Viet Cong, which weren't. So you could probably say that the Viet Cong were fighting an asymmetric warfare, but the NVA were fighting more of a traditional warfare. But again, so, Vietnam, the front line was fluid. There was no proper front line in Vietnam either.
But I guess in your eyes, you know, when you're doing patrols on the streets of Derry, you know, every person you look at could potentially be, you know, did you have that mentality in your head at all?
Oh, absolutely. You went out there as soon as you left the front gates. You were hyper alert. You know, every bin could have held a potential IED. When you crossed the road, you did it in a controlled situation tactically. So you always had one person on the ground scanning the area to make sure you were safe. When you stopped for a couple of minutes, you're doing checks around you to make sure you're looking for wires or disturbed earth or maybe a brick out of place. As you're constantly patrolling along, you're thinking, right, if I get engaged from now, I'm going to go to my right here. There's a fire position I can take cover in there. So your mind's in overdrive all the time you're on patrol.
But if I was to ask you then, how was it engaging with the IRA? I'd imagine you still probably had some sort of, you know, interactions with them, I guess.
Yeah, there's all that. I think every terrorist campaign starts off with the terrorists taking on the army at a shooting game. And that never works out because you're never going to beat an army, a professionally trained army, just by shooting at them because they'll invariably get the jump on you. And you see that in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. And then you end up this circle of development and violence whereby the IRA are developing techniques and new bombs and new methods, and then the British are catching up on those tactics and developing tactics, techniques and procedures in order to defeat them, and it's constantly evolving. And the IRA were a very good, efficient and professional organization and how they went about the business, and they were not to be underestimated.
They were it was very difficult to identify how the IRA operated because, you know, like say if you're on a street patrol, you're always alert. And then when you're out in the van patrols out in the country, I guess if this was 1988, I guess the South Armagh Sniper Brigade would have been going around this time. So I don't know what that would have been too relevant where you were.
No, I mean, I think these sort of trained shooters were in the late 80s and onwards. A lot of these shoots were done at distances that were like a couple hundred meters. You know, an army sniper will shoot out to hundreds of meters, but a lot of these guys got in quite close. And in South Armagh, you couldn't travel around the roads in vehicles because it was just too dangerous for the army to do so. So all movement around South Armagh was by helicopter.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, Colin, so you said you lost two men in your company. Was that to bombs or what happened?
That was to a roadside IED, improvised explosive device. So they were going along in a vehicle move, and an IED was detonated and killed two of them instantly, and badly wounded several others who were later had to be discharged because they were unfit to carry on.
So yeah, you were on leave in Scotland when you found out that the two of your friends were killed, I guess.
Yeah, you got 5 days leave during this time. So I was on leave and my mum came in and said, no more mobile phones back then. So my mum came in and said, there's two soldiers been killed in Derry this morning. And bear in mind, my unit wasn't the only unit in Derry. So I said, look, I'm going to meet my sister in the pub later on. Can you call her at her shop and let her know? And I got to her shop, she told me, still no news. They went to the pub and my friends Steve and Amo, their faces came up and it just, a smack in the face to me. But I was looking around the pub and nobody gave a toss. It was like, what are we doing over there? You know, nobody cares.
But I don't know, is that just a feeling you get whenever you're stationed somewhere that like back home, the country just doesn't really care about you or they don't care about the war or they forget about the war? Or?
Well, funnily enough, we recorded another podcast about Afghanistan. And I remember talking to soldiers from my unit, who are still serving in my old unit, who are in Afghanistan. And I turned around and said to them, you know, Northern Ireland soldiers who served Northern Ireland became yesterday's chip wrappers. And I goes, and this will happen to people in Afghanistan. I said, in 4 or 5 years' time, nobody give a toss about Afghanistan. And you look what's happened to Afghanistan, nobody cares anymore. I mean, the total fiasco of the withdrawal and leaving those people in desperate situations. And it's politicians, you know, and as you become older, you realise politicians are only in things for themselves. They don't really care about the people.
Yeah. And do you feel that yourself, like you're, you know, over the past 20, 30 years, do you feel like you've, as you soften in your older age, like most people do, if you don't mind me saying?
No, I think you're right. I think that's why being a soldier or even being a terrorist requires young people because they're idealistic and, you know, they're driven by those ideals or maybe a search for adventure. And don't get me wrong, and I don't want to say this the wrong way, but as a soldier, you go to Northern Ireland and you think it's going to be exciting. You know, it's what you want to do. And I would say that's probably the same for young men that joined the Provisionals or the Protestant terrorist groups. You know, part of it is idealism, but part of it is out of excitement. And I think as you get older, you look at the bigger picture and you realise, you know, well, politicians, they're just doing what they do. But I went back to Northern Ireland in 2010. I went to Belfast and I had mixed views about what the political process, but I completely changed my view over that 2 or 3 days because the Northern Ireland I visited in 2010, even though the peace process is flawed, it was such a better place than I ever remembered. And I walked away saying, a flawed peace is better than no peace.
Yeah, absolutely. And who would in any way want to go back to this at all, you know?
Oh, you couldn't. I mean, it's horrendous. You think, as you said, you know, a bomb went off. It's just the local news, a bomb's going off everywhere. But on mainland Britain, you only ever heard about it if somebody was killed.
Yeah. And Colin, how do you feel about the vilification of some of the soldiers? You know, like, say, we're in a time right now where the British government is trying to put an end to troubles related prosecutions. It's been met with quite fierce resistance in Northern Ireland. But, you know, like say the likes of, I don't know whether you're familiar with like Soldier F and one of the soldiers involved in Bloody Sunday, which was the SAS Parachute Regiment. Like, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like it's painting everyone with the same brush? Or do you feel like there are aspects of the army that were inappropriate operating in Northern Ireland?
I think it's a very difficult one because no matter what answer I give, it's never going to satisfy anybody. My own personal thoughts is that the difference between the army and the IRA, for example, is that I don't think any soldier got up that morning and went out on a patrol with a specific aim of killing anybody. Whereas a terrorist would get up in the morning, and if he was going on his mission, he was setting out to kill someone. Yes, the army made mistakes and people pay dearly for that. With regard to the prosecutions, I really think Northern Ireland could have done with a peace and reconciliation committee like in South Africa. And I think if there are a number of IRA terrorists given the so-called lists of comfort, excluding them from prosecution by Tony Blair, to me, if you had the peace and reconciliation committee, I think, you know, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. I'm probably not explaining myself very well there. You know, if you're not
I can intervene over a bit. Where I guess the constant argument from the paramilitary side is that they would not be engaging in violence if they didn't have a political aim to accomplish. So that's why I guess they said, look, you may have killed this number of people, but because we're ending the political strife in a way, you're not going to return to violence, I guess. And then they put on some very, very strict kind of measures. So there was the fellow, what's his name? Yeah, there was the likes of, like, say, Michael Stone, the loyalist who threw the grenade in the cemetery.
But he actually set off a chain of events that were hugely influential.
Yeah, well, you know, it had already been set off, actually, because of what happened
with Gibraltar.
Because that is kind of something I did want to ask about, which is the controversial shoot to kill, which would have been, it happened a number of times across the Troubles, but I guess we could try and go to something that was kind of near your deployment, which was in Gibraltar, when the three provisional IRA members were shot dead by the SAS. There's a lot to unpack in that. So of course, I'm not trying to make you give all the answers, because I'm really just looking for kind of your insight. And again, it's one of many thousands of people that were there and that took part in it. But say the complications around the people going to Gibraltar, I guess, is that there was intelligence to suggest that they were going there, and there was intelligence to suggest that they had been followed. And then basically in the process of them, I think they were planting the bomb car, or they were just choosing a place to put the bomb car. The three of them were then shot dead by the SAS. So the argument for the likes of this sort of stuff is, you know, should they have been intercepted earlier and arrested, or was shooting them the only option available to the army at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, go back to something I mentioned earlier on, where you've got a split second to make a decision, you know, and I think, you know, those guys, those SAS guys were moving in on a terrorist cell, and I can't remember the exact, but I think one of the terrorists was alleged to have made a move for a weapon, and that's why they got engaged by the SAS team. But you know, a soldier makes a split second decision, and that is the environment you're working in. When you have to make life or death decisions in not even a second. And I have to say, we used to use a phrase called "big boys rules." You know, at the end of the day, it's either you or them. And if you're in a situation where somebody's pulling a weapon on you, and you know they're a determined terrorist, it's you're in a split second environment to make a decision.
Yeah,
and it's up to and after that, it's up to the courts to decide.
But do you think soldiers should be prosecuted today?
No, I know this would be very, very controversial. But I go back to the reasons I said. I think, terrorists getting letters of comfort saying they're not going to be prosecuted for their crimes, I don't think soldiers should be. I think this would be a blanket application to both sides. They're going to upset an awful lot of people when you're saying that. But I think, you know, I just think if one side's got get out of jail free cards, the other side should.
Yeah, one thing I haven't actually asked you about yet, Colin, was did you have much of an experience seeing loyalist paramilitaries operating?
Yeah, the army knew of them, and you knew who the players on both sides were.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were very much on the lookout for both sides of the organisation. You know, I know there was a lot of talk about the British Army colluding and the RUC colluding with Protestant terrorist organisations. I have no idea about that. I mean, may well have happened above my pay grade, if I'm honest. You know, I go back to that phrase, the dirty war. You start getting into the intelligence side of things, it's very murky. We were aware of who the terrorists on both sides were.
Yeah, and you probably wouldn't have been aware of the double agents then or anything. That would have been kind of, if somebody came into you, if they walked into you and they're like, hi, I need to speak to someone, you'd just be like, right, go that way. You know, like, that's a whole difference. Just a whole different thing, I guess.
That never happened to me, but if you were, you knew what to do if that situation arose, when you would point people.
Yeah, you knew where to point people, where to go.
And you bring up an interesting point here. You know, there's two sides to the campaign in Northern Ireland. There was the green, what we call the Green Army, the soldiers on the streets. And we used to joke and call ourselves Figure 11 targets. Figure 11 is a type of man-sized target you get in an army range. And we used to refer to ourselves as Figure 11s for the IRA. And then you had the behind-the-scenes war, where you'd have the intelligence war and, you know, the undercover operations.
Yeah, which were just absolutely rampant. Like I said, I did in Iraq this season. I also did Steak Knife. And Steak Knife it's amazing how, I guess, infiltrated the IRA was at one point. You know, you do forget that being paramilitary doesn't pay very well. And now there's an argument that this was, you know, a propaganda piece put out that the IRA was full of holes. But from the extensive research that I've done for now, there was a lot of double agents, and there was a lot of just people who were informing in some way on their neighbour or on the goings-on in the area, you know?
I mean, go back to what we talked about a couple of seconds ago. The British Army soldier in uniform on the streets of Northern Ireland did not win, or did not get to the stage where they were defeating the IRA. It was the intelligence war behind the scenes that was doing it.
And your family back home, when they knew you were on the streets of Derry, were they worried about you more so than in other places you were stationed? Or
That tour of Derry I did was the first time I'd been away in operations. So, yeah. And it's hard for people who didn't grow up during the Troubles. You know, there were bombs going off in the UK mainland. You know, it was a very extensive terrorist campaign. So soldiers were getting killed every year. You know, so when I went out there, my family were very worried about what I was getting into.
Then I just want to ask, this is just a bit of a silly one, but when I was younger, I did this amazing kind of adventure trip down in Guyana, in the northernmost tip of South America. And out there was a man by the name of Ian Craddock, who's former SAS, and he's the person who runs all of these adventure expeditions in South America. He was the boss of Bear Grylls, which I thought was very interesting. And they used to call over to Bear's house and meet Lady Grylls, which is Bear's mother. I always thought it was a great name, Lady Grylls. But Ian told me he was stationed in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And he said that when he got blown up once, so he was in one bombing at one time. Now, and this is what I'm trying to see off you. What's your opinion of this? But he said that when he went to the hospital after the bombing, he was begging the nurse to give him more stitches, because the British Army paid more per stitch. So does that sound like complete BS, or is that a real thing?
No, I think it's truthful. I think you could, if I remember correctly, you got a criminal compensation from the police for injuries received. So, if I recall, I think if you were injured in a bombing or you got a brick in the head, you could claim compensation under criminal injuries compensation.
I think he was telling you the truth. He passed away there a couple of years ago. He was an amazing, just his sense of adventure down in South America was really, really fascinating. Colin, I have a couple of Instagram questions for my followers, if you don't mind.
Fire away.
And I got one asking about the drug culture in the army. Did you see it? Was it bad, or was it just as normal as any other kind of job, or as normal as any other?
What back in the 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah, back in the '80s, I would say, from my own personal experience, the main drug in the army at times was alcohol.
Okay.
There was a big drinking culture in Germany with alcohol. And in the late 80s, they introduced compulsory drug testing. But guys used to go to Holland. Not, this wasn't like rife. You know, you, one or two guys would go drive to Holland and maybe have a spliff in the one of the cafe bars there.
Yeah, that's so that's pretty much the club. People have been doing that for decades.
Yeah. Exactly. That was the extent of it. But yeah, well, drinking, sorry. Well, there was a massive drinking culture in the army. Yeah. But same.
How would you, like, say if you're stationed in Derry, like, how do you, like, can you go out? You can't go out to the city and have a few pints, can you? Just not in uniform?
No, there was no drinking allowed. You couldn't drink when you were on tour there, and you couldn't go out. There were, if you're in the resident battalion that was there for 2 years, there was areas you could go to, but not if I recall right, it wouldn't be Londonderry, it'd be more safer areas. Because if you look back in the early days of trouble, soldiers were kidnapped off the streets and murdered as well.
Oh yeah, and look, if there was any bar that was known to take soldiers, you know, it'd be a massive target for the bar if they knew that British soldiers were stationed there. But so the podcast I was listening to, Colin, it wasn't yourself then that got blinded, was it? Or was that the person you were talking to? Just temporarily blind in the attack.
Oh, that was Neil. Yes, Neil was the guy who was involved in the IED where two of our friends got killed.
And I found that interesting that Neil explained, like, so the first hospital they went to, to instantly try and, you know, save their lives, they're in a hospital. But they were treated very, very well by the Protestant nurses. But then the shift change happened and the Catholic nurses came on. And the Catholic nurses basically, like, one of them stuck a thermometer through the lining of his neck or something, and they knocked him over. And so it was completely different, like day and night, when the shift changed for
and that was the first time I'd heard of that, which was interesting to me as well, that you had that. Again, it speaks to the hatred in the communities. It speaks to my attitude. You know, when you asked me what I thought about soldiers being prosecuted, I was initially quite hesitant to. You're always answering questions when it comes to Northern Ireland, trying to be the voice of reason. And then you asked me out bluntly, did I support it or not? And I thought, no, I'm going to nail my colours to the mast here. And I said,
well, the last thing I want to do is ask loaded questions. But, you know,
I'm just saying it's these are complicated conversations we're having and difficult. And, you know, I think when Neil was telling me that, even I didn't know how the nurses were like that. And it's you know, you've grown up in the South. I did those tours there, and it's I don't know if a listener who hasn't got your background or my background would even understand what we're talking about here, that the sort of emotions behind it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the historical context and everything back 600 years and all this sort of stuff, you know, like there was something I read that, like, Ulster before it was the plantations occurred, you know, it was the most Gaelic, it was the most Irish part of all of Ireland. And it was also the one that was just hit the hardest, I guess, with get off our land, or basically given no chances from 1600 years ago. And that came to a head, obviously, with the civil rights movement in the 60s, you know. Yeah. And
the plantations, that's why the west of Scotland has such a link with that sectarianism, because a lot of the plantations, a lot of Scottish people involved in that.
Yeah, I didn't realize until I saw it in a documentary that, like, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, they're both Scottish names. You know, I didn't know that.
Right, yeah. So, but then again, this is the age of empire, isn't it? Because you think the plantations, they don't call them the plantations in Scotland, you call them the Highland Clearances.
Yeah, so, okay, because I did a chat with a Scottish lady a while ago, and she explained to me the Highland Clearance, and I wasn't sure if that was... So the Highland Clearance led to the, kind of, I guess, what we call the Cromwellian Plantation. That was in around the... Oh, was it the 1600s or the 1400s? But did one lead to the other, do you know?
No, they were two separate. But, you know, it's part of how England ruled at the time. So, you know, following Culloden, and I hope my history isn't too sketchy here, but you're following Culloden and the putting down of the Scottish Rebellion, they, you know, replace the population with sheep, essentially. And that's why you've got such big Scottish communities in places like Canada, because they're moved off the land.
Yeah, it was cheaper to keep sheep on than tenants, I think, wasn't it? Or it was,
absolutely, yeah. And they were forced off. I mean, not to the extent of the horrific potato famine and all the rest of it over in Ireland. But, yeah, so British history and how the English treated the Gaelic communities is very interesting, shall we say.
Yeah, well, like, say Northern Ireland was primarily settled by Scots, and if it's these Scots who were forced off their land, it's how you can see that still today, you know, they feel tethered to the land that they have so much and so intensely, you know, because of the historical context on both sides. You know, both in a sense were kicked off their own land. So yeah.
What and they you see coming to roost down Scotland and even Wales with the devolved governments. You know, in some respects, you've got Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, where the whole unification piece is gotten a bit quiet, but then the volume's turned up in Wales and Scotland.
Yeah.
And there's a real anti-English feeling in parts of Scotland.
Well, I guess Scotland was dragged into a Brexit that it didn't necessarily want, or that the majority of it didn't seem to want, you know.
That's correct, yeah. They voted against it. So it's amazing. We could sit here for the next 3 months on a permanent conversation, O'Sheen. These little tentacles of history that spread out from Northern Ireland, they're very far-reaching.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like one of the things I find very interesting is just like, well, I just did an episode on Edward Carson, kind of the birth of unionism, I guess, or the, you know, he was known as the father of Northern Ireland. But a lot of his concerns, a lot of the signing of the Solemn League and Covenants and all this sort of stuff, I think around 1914, very, very similar to the DUP's reaction to Brexit and how they feel like, and, you know, and how their all of their anger is based at the English government and saying, you're leaving us alone, you're abandoning us, you know. So, and this damn near the same feckin' argument happened 100 years ago. You know, and so that's one thing I find interesting, how it's just repeating itself, just with different names and slightly different players, but it's still exactly the same kind of circumstances.
One of my favourite quotes about Northern Ireland was, I think it came from Churchill, who said, every time you find an answer to the Irish question, the Irish change the question.
That's a tough one.
But I think that could apply to Scotland as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do one more question then, Colin, if you don't mind. Again, I could keep you for hours, but I suppose we'll try and keep a bit of a structure on this. I understand that you feel there should be kind of there should be a fair split. If the paramilitaries are released, then the soldiers should necessarily have the same sort of amnesty, I guess. But apart from that, how do you feel about the peace process in Northern Ireland itself? Do you think it came at the right time? Do you think it was the best of a bad situation? I think that for the most part, British soldiers were very against the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, I mean, initially I felt we'd been sold down the river by the government. And, you know, I had friends killed and few friends out there, as we've discussed. However, that all changed when I did that visit to Belfast in 2010. And that really was a game changer for me. I was walking around and seeing how things had improved. And don't get me wrong, you know, you can still see the, you know, they have tours of the demarcation lines in Belfast now, you know, and tours of the murals. So the history's still there, and beneath the surface, it still beats, you know, and the IRA moved into crime and there's still, you know, terrorism going on in the background. But I moved from being against it to thinking this is a good thing. It may be flawed, but it's a good thing. And people can go about their lives without fear. And that's a huge thing.
And I think that was kind of a staple of the Troubles. There was some very, very polarizing sides. But in the middle of it, there were so many people who just wanted to get food for their family, you know, just live a normal. And it was very difficult. You know, the economic situation in Belfast was, it had stopped being such a power horse in the city, I guess. And even Northern Ireland itself, like the country was not doing well. And it was very hard to just make a living, especially when, you know, every other day there was a road blocked off or there was some, you know, a bombing or anything. It was, the vast majority of people just wanted to live their lives, you know.
And you see that again, that's been my experience in places like Iraq, Bosnia. Most people just want to get on with their lives in peace and quiet and just want a future for the children.
So you left Northern Ireland and you subsequently went on to be stationed in Iraq and then Bosnia, was it?
Yeah, I went to, I served a couple in places like Bosnia and Iraq. Yeah. And, you know, the parallels between the population caught in the middle between two warring factions and children and what you see happen to them. And it's heartbreaking. And that's war, isn't it? You know, that's conflict and war. It's always women, children, and innocents that suffer.
Yeah, and the never-ending cycle, I guess. You know, the murder of someone's father or family figure then puts them into...
You're seeing it now in the Ukraine. The vast majority of the population, women and children, will suffer there if that kicks off.
One thing that sticks very poignantly with me was when I was talking to Richard Moore, the person who was blinded by a batting round, whereas when he was, you know, in his bed... his sight is gone. He's 7 or 8, I think. And his brother is like, you know, they murdered my uncle. They blinded Richard. We have to fight back. We can't let them keep killing us like this. And his parents just said, that's not it. That's not the answer. And all of his life now, and he's gone on to do amazing things, but like he's never once turned in that direction, which it's very hard not to turn into hate, to give into hate, you know. And well, you know, I'd imagine even in the army, if every single day, you know, you're getting spat on or literally having shit thrown at you and everything, like, it must be very hard to be as impartial as possible, you know, when you're faced with just an entire population that just, I guess, is, in a way, hate you, you know?
I think you become inured to it, you're right. And, you know, we had a memorial service for a few friends that were killed so on that week, that's 4 years ago. And there was people turned up that I'd seen since Londonderry, Derry. And I talked to one of the guys that was injured in that attack, and he was 19 years old and he was injured. And he'd never worked. Like, he was discharged out of the army and he'd never worked again. Neil, the guy we interviewed on the podcast, suffers from recurrent PTSD. Now I'm not trying to say it's not about what about to read. The point I'm making is the suffering goes on long after the event for people on both sides.
Did you find there was any trouble, I guess, because you're in four different theatres, I guess. Did you find that is it tough to come home and just live a normal life after you know, being in the army like this?
I think you'd have to take some time. I mean, when you had your 5 days off, leave your R&R from Northern Ireland and I came home for 5 days, you're absolutely wired. All your senses are wired, and you're walking down the street and you're still that hyper alert. So it's hard to explain. And then,
well, I guess because Northern Ireland is so, like, I guess, you know, say Iraq is a vastly different place, but when you're operating in an area that is just like your home, I guess it's eerily similar, you know.
Yeah. Oh, good example is, you know, I went to Belfast in 2010. I got off the aircraft and went to the hotel and went for a walk around the streets. I felt exposed walking around the streets. The voices, the accents were like freaking me out.
Yeah, it just brings it straight back, I guess. Yeah.
That's like 16, 17 years since I've been there. And I was like nervous. Really surreal.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Absolutely, the remnants of the past, I guess.
Yeah,
but I think that's it, Colin. I think I'm all out of questions, unless there's anything else you'd like to say. But thank you so much
for the opportunity.
Oh, actually, if you wouldn't mind, Colin, could you maybe tell the listeners a little bit about the podcast that you have?
Oh yeah, thank you, Oshie. So it's called the Unconventional Soldier Podcast. We cover a bit about the unit I told you about that involved the Stay Behind role against Soviet forces. And then we cover a whole host of other subjects, including Operation Banner. We've got a podcast on that. And if you look for the Unconventional Soldier podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from, you should be able to find it. So.
The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or simply telling your friends. It all helps.